This week we've decided to split the cycling podcast episode into two parts, and this is part one.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Daniel Freeb.
Hello, Rich. Do I not? Am I not entitled to the usual introduction now that I'm in the same country as you?
You're in London, so no more Daniele Freeberincini, just plain old just Daniel yet. Freeb at the moment.
Yeah.
And Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard. Hello, Daniel.
Hello.
Hello. Well, I don't know about you, chaps. I'm a bit tired today after I did a 7-hour, 250-kilometre. Ride no, on didn't. The turbo trainer yesterday.
You absolute liar.
Someone did though, didn't they? Who was it that? Well, there've been
Robert Hessink.
A lot of epic on the turbo trainer.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean,
but it was kind of virtual pseudo reality, wasn't it? He was practically
as indoor cycling goes. It wasn't really cycling. My vision of indoor cycling. He's got he's got a setup on his terrace in Andorra, overlooking the mountains. Even you could overcome your fear and loathing of Andorra, Lionel, with that sort of setup, I think.
I was, as you know, I was a devotee of turbo training in my youth, as we touched on briefly last week. But I don't know if I'm going to upset any of our sponsors. I don't think I am by saying this, but I was shocked at how expensive turbo trainers are now. I had a quick look yesterday. Smart trainers. I would have to remortgage the chateau to afford one.
Yeah, I have to say though, and you know, just to repair some of the damage just done in the last few seconds by Daniel to any.
We don't have a sponsor that makes.
No, we
trainers,
don't
do
currently.
We,
no, but it's a completely different experience. I mean, it's like comparing sailing with power boating. You know, it going on a smart trainer is compared to a turbo trainer is. I mean, I first used one, I think, 18 months ago or so, and I was blown away by the different experience. Not trying to sell them or anything, but it is a completely different thing now. Anyway, chaps, how are you both coping? We're all kind of locked down now. It's a bit vague, and if there's a bit of noise here at my end from my house, it's because the builders next door are carrying on regardless, which is just sort of symptomatic of a certain vagueness in the UK. But how are you both coping with being housebound?
Well, going back to the previous discussion about the turbo trainer, I mean, you know, smart trainers, they're sort of, well, I'm probably infamous for not liking gimmickry and, you know, well, my loathing of indoor cycling is well known. But yeah, the sort of minimalist Spartan existence is something that sort of appeals to me anyway. I feel like I've been training for this for the last, you know, 10 years. So it's not that much of a readjustment for me. I mean, on a sort of serious, semi-serious note, you know, rightfully, there's a lot of talk at the moment about preserving sort of mental health and looking after people's mental health. And, you know, the sort of debate about whether you should or shouldn't be riding your bike and exercising sort of feeds into that. But, you know, I think maybe what's being ignored slightly is that for some people's mental health, this is probably quite salutary, in the sense that, you know, the sort of introverts among us, we're constantly trying to sort of dial down the level of stimulation and the number of decisions we have to make on a daily basis. And, you know, from my point of view, sort of going to a shop on the rare occasions that I do go to a shop and not really having any choice in the matter, I find quite refreshing personally. But I know that's not everyone's experience.
Interesting. I mean, I suppose, we've all been freelancers for a long time, haven't we? I think I'm kind of used to working on my own at home. I suppose having my family here all the time is the thing I'm adjusting to, because normally I would be able to, you know, lock myself away and carry on working. Now I have to consider other people, which is, I mean, you know, difficult.
It doesn't come naturally, does it?
No. No, thanks, Rich. So, yeah, I've got an 18-month-old running about in the garden. From my point of view, the turbo trainer's set up, ready for a spin this afternoon. I'll probably reactivate Zwift, which I've used before. Speaking of which, Mitch Docker's Life in the Peloton episode this week will be worth listening to, as we all adjust to training indoors. It's with his coach, Kevin Poulton, who was also Matt Heyman's coach in 2016. Yeah, when Heyman crashed at Omloop Het Nieuwsblad, looked like his classic campaign was over, but he trained indoors on Zwift and won Paris-Roubaix. And it's kind of the story of slightly of that, but more from the kind of the benefits of indoor training. So that's worth listening out for. That will be released on Wednesday, Life in the Peloton, on our feed. But from my own point of view, I will probably point the turbo trainer and the bike so that I can look out of the back door of my office into the garden, and maybe as the temperatures warm up, might even move the turbo outdoors onto the decking. And
that's a good idea.
Just why on not? On the turbo training, there was a really good interview that Thibaut Pinot did with France Télévisions yesterday, in which he talked about turbo training, and he's a sort of savage forest dweller like myself, you know, man of the natural world, and he's not really he's not really into smart trainers and so on. But he did make a point that I've not sort of considered before, that you sweat an awful lot when you are using the turbo trainer, and he said you lose so many mineral salts that if you do very, very long sessions, a lot of very long sessions, it's actually very bad for you. But I presume there are ways to compensate for that, proper hydration.
Well, yes, indeed. Early plug for Science and Sport. Well, listen, let's get into this week's probably very long episode. You know, there's a challenge for us in this period, but it's an opportunity as well. And we're aware that some of you will be listening to the Cycling Podcast to get away from, as a release from news of coronavirus. But equally, some of you will be listening to hear the latest news about coronavirus as it relates to professional cycling and how it's affecting riders, teams and races. So we're going to try and balance our coverage over the coming weeks, starting today, reflecting on some past races, fresh interviews with some of the riders caught up in this. And in this spirit, in the first part of this episode, we're going to be talking about all things Milan-San Remo, reliving last year's win by Julian Alaphilippe with his teammates Tim de Klerk and Zdeněk Stybar. We'll also later on be hearing from Marco Pinotti, the former rider who's now a CCC coach. Did I say CCC coach? Who lives in Bergamo, which is the current epicentre of the coronavirus crisis. We've also got an interview with EF Pro Cycling boss Jonathan Vauters about the latest developments. We'll also get the first installment of Lockdown with Larry. That's Larry Warbass of AG2R, with his thoughts about how he's dealing with things. And that might become a regular feature. We're hoping to hear from other riders as well as this goes on. I think one of the things that struck me is that maybe now we can all relate to riders who have a long-term injury. I was watching an old Milan-San Remo video featuring Henrik Hausler, and he was talking about being out of action and not really sure when or if he could come back. Also, thinking about your Revenant special with Marco Haller and Bernard Eisel, Daniel. You know, the situation as things stand, we're all kind of collectively out with a long-term injury, or, you know, that's kind of what it feels like. And that sense of uncertainty and missing out and really missing it is something we can probably all relate to now a bit better.
Well, and I think particularly something that I've got from Heinrich Hausler the last couple of years, I mean, I think I talked about it on the podcast. I had a sort of chance meeting with him in Berlin a couple of years ago when he was pretty convinced that his career was over. And just observing him and speaking to him over the last couple of years at races, he feels as though he's been given a sort of a tenth life. He's gonna extract the absolute maximum from that, and he really seems to be someone who's loving just being at races and being able to compete and being healthy again.
Daniel, you say a chance meeting there. I mean, this is a spin-off series, isn't it? I'll carry on with those eventually when we're all allowed to go out for lunch again.
And can you do virtual lunches?
Yeah, virtual lunch. You can do chance meeting with. So far, exactly. We've got Degan Colburn and Hausler.
Mick Bennett.
Another spin-off, Turbo Training with Daniel Freib.
Yes.
And actually, we've got a special episode coming up devoted largely to that. More details to follow. We don't have a news roundup this week, but there is some news that we wanted to deal with at the start of the show, isn't there, Lionel?
Yeah, very sad news that the veteran and very highly respected Italian journalist Gianni Mura, also known as Punto for reasons Daniel will explain shortly, passed away this week. And we're going to hear a little bit of Gianni Mura's voice here.
Affermi che lo champagne è come una cronosquadre.
Lo champagne è fatto in genere è il concorso di un uvaggio, cioè di diversi vitigni che sono lo Chardonnay, il Pinot Nero, il Pinot Meunier,
sì,
di base, e ognuno ci mette del suo, ma a quella...
So that was the voice of Gianni Mura, chaps. That was on an Italian chat show a few years ago when he was being asked about his profession. He was being asked about, you know, some of his writing and this metaphor he'd come up with for team time trials, and he'd likened it to champagne because champagne is made with three grape varieties. One is Pinot Noir, Pinot Meunier, and Chardonnay. And you know, Gianni was just sort of explaining there how in the Champagne region those three grapes don't yield very much. They're not all that great, or they wouldn't be as sort of single varietal wines, but you put them together and they add up to this they can add up to this fantastic wine if they're sort of compensating each other in the right way. But that was sort of typical of the way he saw the world, the way he saw cycling. He was a real sort of bon vivant, a restaurant critic as well, and it's just been interesting to observe over the last couple of days since his death just how much his work resonated. There's been tribute videos from Michel Platini, the French footballer who played in Italy in the 80s, and Gianni Mura covered football as well. And for most of us who have covered the Tour de France over the last few decades, he was unmistakable. He became famous for being the last journalist, certainly at cycle races, to use a typewriter. He used an Olivetti 51, I think, or 51 or 53 machine, which in itself became this sort of mythical object in the press room. You would hear him tapping away. You would see him there, often surrounded by food. Actually, he would come in with a punnet always of apricots or cherries. And a bottle of red wine often as well, and a real sort of throwback. And that was when he was in the press room. Very often he'd be outside the press room because you could no longer smoke in Tour de France press rooms from, I guess, for quite a long time now. So he would sort of take up residence just outside the press room, and he'd be tapping away and, file these magnificent pieces, which, placed him in the pantheon of Italian sports journalism, which itself has a more literary tradition, I would say, than sports journalism in a lot of other countries. The Giro d'Italia has been a real platform for that, has really showcased that. Some of the great sort of novelists of the 20th century in Italy were dispatched to cover the Giro d'Italia at times, and similarly some of the sports reporters were fated and sort of mentioned in the same breath as some of the great novelists. But the other sort of idiosyncrasy for which Gianni Mura became very well known was Lionel, you mentioned the fact that the English press pack really had nicknamed him Punto. And the reason for this was that when he was filing his copy, so he would type out his race reports on the Olivetti, and then he would call the Repubblica, was the newspaper they worked for, he'd call their copy desk in Rome, and he would dictate the piece, and at the end of every sentence he would say punto, this kind of exclamatory punto, which is actually just a full stop in Italian. But I vividly remember the first time that I became aware of this. It was the 2001 Tour de France, and it was my first Tour de France, and Gianni Mura was sitting in front of me, and it was actually, I think it was Bastille Day, and it was a stage in the Vosges Mountains, and Ivan Basso, who was riding his first Tour de France for Fassa Bortolo, had got into a break with Laurent Jalabert, and Basso had crashed onto on a descent coming into the finish, and that had allowed Jalabert to win easily. But anyway, I was sitting behind Gianni Mura, and I remember him reading out the copy, filing his copy, and in Italian, the way you spell words is you say the names of cities. So Ivan Basso became Imola, Venezia, Ancona, Napoli, Ivan Basso was Bologna, Ancona, Savona, Otranto, which is a place in Puglia. And he would do this with almost every word. So it would be like, you know, someone was sort of reciting the stages of the of a Giro d'Italia for you know,
it would have
half
taken
an hour. It took him forever.
Fibrincini.
It took him forever. But I was curious because La Repubblica actually have their archive online, and I was curious as to whether I could find this piece that I'd heard him dictate, and I just picked out a couple of lines as you know, literally the lines I was listening to him dictate. And he said, if anyone's interested in a personal opinion, at a difficult time for him, Ivan Basso is a rider. In this sport, the lack of adjectives is a compliment. If the way he rode wasn't enough, this sentence at the finish line would suffice. If my collarbone's not broken, I'll try again tomorrow. So, you know, that was kind of fairly typical of a lot of what Gianni Mura would write. A very sort of stripped down conversational style, but there was this great sort of wisdom. And also at times, you know, his writing could be sort of very sort of florid and expansive as well. But very often it was just sort of like sitting next to Gianni Mura, who had this sort of appearance of this kind of languid, weary old walrus who had sort of seen and done everything in sports journalism.
And he was a restaurant critic as well, Daniel, wasn't he? Did he not write restaurant reviews with his wife? And all I know, I didn't, unfortunately, wasn't able to enjoy his great writing in Italian, but I do know that if we went into a restaurant and Gianni Mura was there, that it was a good restaurant at the Tour de France.
Yeah, that became a sort of unwritten secret code in the press room, where whenever you saw him at a restaurant, that was always a sign that you'd made a good choice. I didn't know him particularly well. I mean, I was quite intimidated by him, to be honest, because, you know, I knew about his reputation, I knew his writing, and I mentioned how sort of languid he was, but he was someone who could at times look like a bit of a curmudgeon if you didn't know him. I think he was, from what people who knew him better than I did have told me, he was actually a very warm individual, but I was sort of scared to approach him sometimes. And the one occasion when I did was in a restaurant in the Pyrenees. That he loved the Pyrenees. He much preferred the Pyrenees to the Alps, sort of famously. And he was in this restaurant in the Pyrenees with Francesco Guidolin, who is a famous football manager in Italy. And Guidolin used to come to the Tour de France to do a couple of stages and just watch Gianni Mura operate, because that was a spectacle in itself.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a business, find out more at iwalker.co.uk, iwoca.co.uk.
My name is James Turner. I am the IT manager at iWalker. Super passionate about everything to do with bicycles. Been sort of following the industry and racing and taking part in racing for as long as I can remember, and it's something that helps me keep very much sane and occupied in my downtime. I love the fact that iWalka does get involved in not just sort of straight business activities, and iWalka as a company, we see ourselves very much as an enabler for other small businesses. And so I do see the sort of the sporting angle of things being an enabler to society, if you will, as very much more a sort of just an extension on that mission, if you will. We do have on staff quite a few talented athletes from many different sports, but personally, sort of being very involved in cycling myself, selfishly, I really enjoyed that sort of announcement. It was great for me to hear out of the blue from my friends in the marketing department that they were thinking of getting involved initially with cycling, and then seeing the additional activities that have come out of the department has been it's just fantastic.
When I said I needed you, said you wouldn't always stay. It wasn't me who changed, but you. And now you've gone away.
Well, little tantalizing clip there of a treat for you all at the end of this episode. Our good friend Francois Thomazeau with a song linked to Milan Sanremo, which he'll explain later and which we're about to talk about. But before we do, a quick thanks to our headline sponsor Iwoca, whose support helps ensure that we can carry on as normal, or as normal as possible at this strange time. Iwoca remains 100% focused on their mission to provide customers with finance they need to bridge cash flow gaps and make investments.
Sean Kelly, previous winner of this race. What a finish. We're going to have the firemen are behind, pumping on the coals to try and catch Marino Argentan in front. Anybody with anything left in his legs wants to get within a shouting distance of this man on the descent of the Poggio. Kelly's going away. Kelly's going to get it. Kelly gets it. Sean Kelly, the winner.
Tacchi con Bonne la ruota, Filippo Pozzato ancora qualche metro,
10 metri ancora,
Pozzato a vincere, Pozzato su metà.
Buonina di Galicia insieme, la notte me ne sogno, la notte me ne sogno, la notte me ne sogno.
Oostler gaat Milan Sanremo winnen. Een Duitser, of Cavendish, of Cavendish, of Cavendish, of Cavendish, het is Cavendish. Fotofinish, fotofinish.
Avec quelle facilité, en même temps de saluer tout le monde 50 mètres avant l'arrivée. Marc Gomez, ah oui, ah ça c'est, on le comprend, j'en reviens pas, dit-il. Formidable, formidable Gomez, formidable Gomez.
Well, without lamenting its absence too much, chaps, that's what we missed at the weekend, Milan-San Remo. A nice little oral reminder of the great race, the first monument of the season, La Classicissima, La Primavera. Which nickname's the right one, Daniel?
Well, definitely not the way you pronounced the first one, Napalm. Jesus Christ. La Classicissima. No, I much prefer La Classicissima to La Primavera, to be honest.
Well, the thing I love about Milan San Remo is that it's long enough to justify a cappuccino, an ice cream, and a pizza.
The other thing, just briefly about La Primavera, we didn't want to get into speculation about what, you know, rearrangement of the calendar, but it could no longer be La Primavera because I understand that the date that's currently in mind for the rescheduling of Milan San Remo is mid-September. That's what RCS are thinking about working on at the moment.
So no, we're not congratulating Nicolo Bonifazio for winning our imaginary Milan San Remo at the weekend. He was heavily tipped by you last week, Daniel.
Based on a chance encounter. In a French boulangerie.
I mean, not just based on that. He was also going pretty well. He was a decent shout, actually. For that, I would have thought. But Julian Alaphilippe was the winner last year, of course. A lot of people, I think, at the weekend watched last year's race again. Did you indulge in any kind of watching back of old Milan San Remos?
I did not.
I have done, actually. I have done. I've been watching the last sort of 15 kilometres of last year's race, and well, the acceleration by Alaphilippe on the Poggio was quite something, wasn't it? He wasn't quite able to get away from everybody. Quite an A-list group sprinting for the win at the finish, wasn't it? I would say, a good addition. I mean, it's difficult now, isn't it? Without a current race to talk about, suddenly the thrill and excitement of last year's race has sort of earned another wine glass on the Daniel Freeb spectrum of bike races. I think it's probably up to 4.5 wine glasses now, maybe.
It does. It gives it. It sort of amplifies it, doesn't it, in a way? Because the cycling season being the way it is means that you move on. We talked about this a bit last week. Paris-Nice taking on new meaning, meaning something in and of itself. And the way the cycling season is structured means that you're no sooner is a race finished than you're actually looking ahead to the next race. There isn't a lot of time to reflect or to really sometimes appreciate the races and the performances that we've seen.
No, and well, Richard, you and I have spoken to a couple of Alaphilippe's De Koenig Quickstep teammates about last year's race, Tim de Klerk and Zdeněk Štybar, to attempt to not butcher the pronunciation of the Czech rider's name. And well, let's hear their memories of the race from 12 months ago.
We should start by saying that Tim de Klerk, I managed to interrupt his one of the many chores that he's performing in this hiatus. He's painting his house, so we hear him mentioning that briefly at the start.
For goodness sake, just force the DIY stores to close for all our sakes.
We've had a 10-man break since the start today. That has gone. Masnada was the last survivor. We then had an attack from Nicolò Bonifacio, the local rider who will know those curves better than anybody else. He's just been taken back and we're all back together.
Yeah, taking the rest period I had normally after the classics, I'm taking it now. So yeah, it's a little bit more boring than otherwise. But my wife gave me a lot of chores to do around the house. So for the moment, it has not been boring yet. But still, I miss it to go outside and meet some friends. But it's the same for everybody, of course. I'm Tim de Klerk, 30 years old, and domestic for the Koenig Quickstep cycling team. I have to paint. I have to paint the room of the little girl we're expecting, and also I cleaned the terraces and I cleaned the whole garden.
Good afternoon, everybody. A very warm welcome to the 291 kilometers from Milan to Sanremo on the home of cycling.
It was one of the days. Normally, there's always something that ruins the plan, but this time there was nothing except maybe for Alaphilippe going for a piss 5k before the Cipressa. That was maybe one of the things that could have ruined the plan, but he was so good, and maybe the weight he lost there helped him to perform even better uphill. So
yeah, Milan Sanremo last year was really a special race. I think also it was one of the best team efforts I was ever in during the race. Because here, you know, we had really extremely good team on the start. We had Elia Viviani, who was definitely in very good shape, and we did believe that he will get over Poggio and he can sprint for the win. We had Philippe Gilbert on the line, who was really going for it also. And then we had Julien, who was in excellent shape, winning Strada Bianca, winning stage in Tirreno, and then so he was ready for Sanremo as well. What I remember was that before Cipressa, like 10 kilometers before, Julien, he said, I just need to have a pee. But you know, everybody was so stressed. Everybody was pushing themselves to be in the front and don't miss the important moment of the race, because yeah, for everybody Cipressa is so important. And he just decided he has to stop, and I was with him, because I just tried to help him to get back into the front. So he had to be really confident.
My job was done after Capo Berta, but I was still in the peloton. I said fuck, what's he doing now? Because everybody was fighting so much for position. But the whole team stayed with him, and I tried to bring him one last time to the front. And the other guys did the rest and did a perfect job.
It's about Bettiol in the past and how good he could be at this race. But again, a man who needs it to change. In the move behind, it's Julien Alaphilippe. Alaphilippe, lift off with Kwiatkowski following him.
We got over Cipressa like without any problem, and then we were together also with Elia Viviani, and just before Poggio, but then on one of the roundabouts, we got in difficulties behind a small crash, and we were really far behind the other teammates. They were on the right side, we were on the left side together, and trying to get to the front. So we lost each other again with Elia, and afterwards we were trying again to get to the front, and then again we lost each other, and then we were like maybe 500 meters in front of the right corner to Poggio, where we had a kind of let's say meeting with the other teammates that that we will just go from there very hard, and that we will take Poggio on our own pace. So I had to move also to the front. In the meantime, I lost Elia. I could still make it to the front, and then actually I think it was Yves Lampaert who bring us into the first 100 meters of Poggio, or maybe 200. And afterwards I took over. I set really hard pace. Afterwards took over again Philip Gilbert, and then me again, and then I was going as long as I could, and then took over again Philip, and on the top, yeah, Julia went really hard, and just few riders could or were able to follow him.
Julia Alaphilippe with still a bit to go towards the top of the Poggio. This is the point last year when Nibali went clear. This is the point where Nibali went clear. Now, Kwiatkowski is chasing. Sagan, the man on the outside, going as well. Trentin, also Naarsen with Valverde just behind him. And there's a rider from Jumbo-Visma.
You know, on that moment when we hit Poggio, I knew that Elia is a little bit more far behind. And we set really very hard pace. We went just from the bottom, really hard. We were like, we could even say that we were just sprinting from one corner to the other. And so on that moment, I knew that I'm really setting very hard pace for Julian, but also that on the same time I'm killing Elia Viviani. To be very honest, I had more confidence in Elia than in Julian. But it was just somehow it came that Julia, he said, yeah, just guys go as hard as you can. And that's what we did. I knew that this pace, Elia can never get over Poggio. So I was just hoping that that Julia can finish it off.
Moritz, the Slovenian champion, being chased by Alaphilippe, 800 meters from the finish now, as they come onto Via Roma. It's Moritz on the right hand side, Alaphilippe behind him, then Sagan. Is this the moment for him? Is this the chance? Sagan, in the meantime, is being followed by Naarsen, also a fast finisher. Trentin is there, Fernandez there as well. Kwiatkowski behind him, but then are they always a danger? As Trentin looks round, they all look around. Now who goes? What happens? It's checkmate maybe, but somebody has to win it. Somebody has to make a move.
And yeah, then we were kind of just waiting for the result in the radio. And what was really amazing is that we did pass with several teammates over the finish line with a hands up, like we were the winners. And we did really enjoy it so much because it was an enormous team effort during the San Remo, and especially the final of San Remo.
Nibali at the back, just a few hundred metres away, as Alaphilippe's going to have to launch it now. The end of Milano-San Remo, the 110th edition. Alaphilippe is going first, they've gone up to the line. Alaphilippe still at the front, it's going to be him. Oh, he can't stop winning. Alaphilippe has it.
Oh, he's a really nice guy to have in the team. It's always a lot of fun with him. And yeah, you can have a lot of laughs. And he's also really grateful. He's a guy that he's an extrovert. He shows how he is. And yeah, it's always a lot of fun with him.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast Team Car, the back of the pack, please.
The voice of Seb Piquet reminds me to tell you that this week's episode of the Cycling Podcast is supported by LACA. LACA is a community of cyclists all working together to insure their bikes and equipment in the event of damage or loss. Ensuring the premiums are lower and the payouts in the event of a claim are swifter, you'll be dealing with people who understand bikes, who will know their Shimano from their SRAM, and that racing bikes and equipment can be expensive. Your premium depends, of course, on the value of your bikes and equipment, and it goes up or down depending on how many other claims there are, but there is a ceiling to the monthly premium. Don't take our word for it. Let's hear from a satisfied LACA customer.
My name's Dan. I am a very keen, but ultimately average road cyclist, and I like to do a little bit of cyclocross and off-road stuff as well. I've been a LACA customer for maybe 2 years now. I've had to make one claim, and it was really, really straightforward, and had the sort of the money come through to get all of the replacement parts within a couple of days, I think. I had another rider into the back of me and put a fairly large dent and a split into the fender on the bike. I was riding an aluminium fender, so couldn't pop them back, and there was a sort of crack across the where the bridge mount was as well, and they were sort of fairly expensive fenders that I imported from the US, and the guys at LACA just allowed me to buy another pair and just gave me the cash for the actual fender and the postage over as well, so that was all good. They literally just I sent them pricing to show how much it was from the website, and they just transferred the money to my account. I think it was the following day, and I just ordered the parts that I needed and got my mechanic to fit them all back on for me.
If that sounds like the sort of bike insurance you'd like, then please go to laka.co.uk. That's laka.co.uk. Well, that was Tim De Klerk and Zdeněk Stybar. De Klerk, of course, the big tall rider that we see sitting on the front for many, many kilometres, helping control things for De Koenig Quickstep. Stybar, bit of a winner in his own right, and a more valuable teammate for Julian Alaphilippe towards the end of Milan San Remo last year. But I was interested. I didn't know about Alaphilippe stopping to answer a call of nature just before the Cipressa, which was new to me. But clearly in great form, and as De Klerk said, perhaps the loss of that weight helped him ultimately over the Cipressa and the Poggio. But I mentioned I watched back the race again, and De Klerk said that they had a plan to really go all in for Alaphilippe instead of Philippe Gilbert and Elia Viviani, both potential winners as well. And watching it, you could see Gilbert really committing to that, and Viviani being sacrificed in trying to help Alaphilippe win the race.
Yeah, it was interesting, Stybar saying that he still felt that Viviani, going into the Poggio, still felt that Viviani might be the better bet.
One thing that struck me, chaps, as well, just listening to that again, I don't think I'd fully appreciated at the time what an absolute dream team that was. If you were going to design a team to win Milan-San Remo, you would probably, you would have that kind of makeup that De Koenig Quickstep had last year, just in terms of having a sprinter's option, having someone like Tim De Klerk who could act as the sort of lawnmower on the front of the peloton for much of the day, and then Alaphilippe as well. The other thing, it just popped into my head when you were mentioning Alaphilippe stopping before the Cipressa, there are quite a number of important bike races won in similar circumstances, when riders seem to harness adrenaline if they have either an enforced stoppage due to a mechanical or a natural break before an important phase of the race. So just wonder whether
that you're bringing this up, Daniel.
Well, it might actually have helped Alaphilippe. I'm now thinking about, remember did it turn out to be a spurious theory we had about Bauke Mollema stopping deliberately before the climbs in the Giro d'Italia. Right. I think it was actually, yeah. I don't think it was Spurious. I think it was True, but he didn't particularly want to dwell on it.
Yeah, was that not, was he not using that to sort of help warm up, to sort of, you know?
He was.
Also, did the weather have a factor in that? I can't remember. It was quite cold at the Giro, wasn't it, last year?
Yes, but if you just think about the sort of last 60 kilometres or last 40 kilometres of Milan-San Remo, they are pure adrenaline, really, aren't they? And it's a race that sort of, well, not just metaphorically, but literally kind of moves through the gears as it goes on. And, you know, it's a mysterious sort of nebulous art winning Milan-San Remo. There are so many great riders, great classics riders who have never managed to win it, despite having been in with a shout and in the right position seemingly on a number of occasions.
Peter Sagan
is one. You know, I talked at length to Mark Cavendish, of course, a former Milan-San Remo winner a year or two ago, and you know, he just talked, and he always talks about the economy and how some riders go a whole career and they never really appreciate those. I mean, he said that it's a race where every single thing you do from the moment you leave Milan matters. Going over a drain cover on the left of the road versus the smooth tarmac in the middle can be the difference between you winning and losing. He also talked about it being a race whose outcome is made of sort of thousands of pixels as opposed to sort of 100 in any other race.
One of my favourite Milan-San Remo memories, though, Daniel, is of Cavendish's win in 2009. I was watching it with a sports writer who had been working with Mark Cavendish on his first book. And this book had been, I think, more or less finished. It was more or less finished, and it was almost off to the printers.
I know what's coming.
When we were watching,
really?
Watching Milan San Remo in an Italian cafe in London. And the minute, of course, I mean, Henrik Hausler went early, and it looked like Hausler had it, and then out popped Cavendish and won the race. And
This
well-known sports writer's head just fell into his hands, and he might have started crying at that point, thinking about the structural problems this would give him with this book.
Yeah, did he say all of that in a Coventry accent?
Yeah, he said a few Italian swear words, some elaborate hand gestures.
That's the ghostwriting equivalent of the sort of injury time goal in a Champions League final, isn't it? Listening to De Klerk and Stibar talking about Alaphilippe. Victory last year, obviously a French winner, and Alaphilippe stopping to answer the call of nature before the Cipressa made a couple of things pop through my mind hearing them speak. But looking back through the list of winners, Frenchmen to have won Milan-San Remo, going back in time, 2016, Arnaud Démare and his amazing car, allegedly.
another example, possibly, depending on whose version you believe, of, you know, someone having had a bit of a setback before the Cipressa, and then again, maybe harnessing the power of adrenaline or harnessing the horsepower of a team car. I don't know.
Well, yeah, the horsepower of the team car, allegedly, strongly denied by Francis Desjeux. Before that, you have to go back to 1995, Laurent Jalabert, and before that, 88 and 89, back-to-back wins for Laurent Fignon. And the reason I'm kind of going a sort of circuitous route to this anecdote, the 1982 Milan-San Remo, won by a at the time little-known Frenchman, Marc Gomez. Actually, his parents were Spanish, but he was born in Rennes, so a Breton. That was the first year that Milan-San Remo included the Cipressa in the route. Now, Daniel, I don't know whether you know more about this particular story than I do, but perhaps this might be one of those myths. But as I understand it, Vincenzo Torriani was the boss of the day, the Mauro Venni of the day, a much more forthright character from everything I've read than Venni, who's a bit of a shrinking violet, it seems to me, anyway. But Torriani was nicknamed the Bull, Toro the Bull, play on his surname, but also his character, apparently. And the early 80s was the kind of the peak of the Francesco Moser and Giuseppe Soroni era, the two great Italian riders. But Torriani was getting a bit fed up with the formulaic finish to Milan-San Remo, and particularly the lack of Italian victories. I think they'd only had two Italian wins in the previous 11 years. And Fons de Wolf's win, a Belgian rider, in 1981 was sort of the last straw for Torriani. So he and his team set about trying to make the finale of the race more difficult. And the Cipressa climb, which is at, is it called San Lorenzo al Mare, Daniel? The
yes,
town?
Yes, it is.
Where the Cipressa starts, you take a right turn off the road, and it rises quite attractively up ahead of you, and then there's another right-hand turn taking you kind of away from San Remo as it doubles back. And it's just under 6 kilometer climb, and Torriani wanted to include the Cipressa in the route. It was pointed out to him that this would add more than 20 kilometres to the route, taking it over 300 kilometres in length, which might be unpalatable to some. So Torriani's answer to that was simply just to print all the race literature, the maps and the routes with a more acceptable distance of 294 kilometres. And of course, no one had a computer or anything to track the distance, so it was taken as read that it was 294 kilometers, but legend is that it was at least 5 or 6 kilometers over 300.
Yeah, this was a theme in Torriani's Giri when he was the Giro director for I think for about 4 or 5 decades, wasn't he? He was infamous for drawing up these routes and putting these climbs on the route, which were nothing like they appeared on paper when the riders got to them. And yeah, the riders always took great exception to this, and he became a bit of a divisive figure, didn't he? But they'd done the same with the Poggio in 1960, and that was sort of brought in to end a run of sprint finishes. And the Cipressa, it's funny, I wrote about the Cipressa in my book Mountain High a few years ago, but and I remember going through the press coverage leading up to that 1982 race, and what most of the main protagonists, main favourites for the race were talking about was the descent, that they thought that would have a bigger impact on the race than the actual climb. And you know, I think it does have a big effect on the climb does have a big effect on the final outcome, but not one that you will necessarily easily discern watching. We've very rarely seen attacks on the Cipressa succeed and a rider or a group go away on the Cipressa and then stay away to the finish.
Well, the winner that year was Marc Gomez, as I said. I mean, he was a first-year professional. He was 26, so he turned pro pretty late. Probably thought his chance had passed him by. He'd been third in the French Amateur Championships the year before and signed for a small team, Wolliber, the people who make tyres. A huge field that year, over 250 on the start line. I think only around 80 finished. But again, a kind of almost anachronistic these days, a field of that size setting off for the race. And not knowing many people, Gomez went to a fellow Breton on the start line to ask for a bit of advice, and he was basically told just go hard from the start and get in the early break, and that's what he did. And he was out there all day. He was with Alain Bondu, a much better known Frenchman, and Gomez pulled off what, you know, a bit like a sort of non-league team winning the FA Cup, really. A real shock, surprise win. And in fact, well, I wrote a collaborative piece with some other journalists when I worked for Cycle Sport magazine about this particular edition of the race. And one of the comments that kind of stood out, one of the quotes from Gomez that stood out, was that he says he rode down the Via Roma into almost silence because no one knew who he was. You know, there was no great kind of fanfare because I don't know whether it's the same these days, but certainly it feels like in those days the Italian victors got much more of a fanfare from the fans than an unknown rider. But one of those editions of Milan San Remo that sort of sticks in my memory, even though, you know, I don't remember watching it at the time. It's there is some footage on YouTube, which we'll post a link to that in the episode notes so that you can watch a little bit of what we're talking about in this episode.
And I can well imagine that scenario, Napalm, of Gomez sort of riding over the finish line in almost silence, because you get, well, one of two things happen after the finish line in Milan-San Remo. If there's an Italian winner, they get mobbed and there's a huge stampede and things become very fractious. The 1993 edition, for example, this led to a sort of traffic jam of team cars as they were coming over the line, and Mario Cipollini got extremely angry with the race director then, Carmine Castellano, and threw his bike through his windscreen. And, you know, it's all the sort of worst cliches of Italians and Italians at bike races come to the fore. So, you know, there's a lot of swearing, a lot of people getting angry. Or riders just carry straight on through, and Via Roma actually continues, well, it goes way out past, or the Via Aurelia, which Via Roma is part of, it continues way out through, well, past the old train station in San Remo, and almost, well, if you continue, you end up basically at the French border. And if you're a journalist there trying to stop riders, it can be a bit of a nightmare. I mean, I've run a couple of kilometres after riders in the past, but there is also this sense that, you know, the race is over and everyone just sort of gets out of Dodge straight away. Almost they don't even get off their bikes, it almost feels like, in some cases. You know, I mentioned talking about Mark Cavendish, who's now a famous winner of Milan-San Remo, and I asked him, you know, what he knew about San Remo apart from the fact that he won this famous edition in 2009, and he knew very, very little. He knew that San Remo had a famous music festival, which most of the riders will know, I guess, but he couldn't really say anything else. And I said, well, have you ever spent any time there? And he said, well, I think I had dinner there once and it wasn't very good, but that's all. And that's fairly typical, I think. You know, the riders, obviously, they arrive in Milan a couple of days before the race, and then as soon as they cross the finish line, they get to a hotel a kilometre or so from the finish line, pack up their stuff, and off they go.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport. Fueled by science.
Well, my name's Chris Hoy. I'm a 6-time Olympic gold medalist and an 11-time world champion. The key thing that people ask me, what, you know, advice, tips for beginners or amateurs, you know, maybe doing a charity ride or a sportive or a big challenge, the biggest thing I would say is don't try something new on race day or on the day that you're doing your challenge. Always train using the same products, using the same routine that you do, that you plan to on race day. Because the one thing you don't want to change with your digestive system when you're perhaps a bit nervous or a bit anxious on the big day is to try something different. And, you know, it is a classic mistake. You think, well, here's all the gels, I'm going to keep them for race day. Get used to using them in training. Plus, you benefit from it in training too. You want to get the benefit leading up in the preparation. It's not just about the race day itself. So, yeah, I learned that the hard way many times. You know, thinking I'd sort of save my good stuff for the big race, and with a few nerves, you're butterflies in the stomach, yeah, you can find yourself dashing to the loo seconds before you're supposed to be on the start line.
Thanks very much to Science in Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast, and well, you can get 25% off with the code SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com. SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com. Very much business as usual for Science and Sport. And if you are doing more indoor cycling, as most of us are, the Hydro and Immune range fits perfectly for indoor training. So check that out at scienceandsport.com. As I think you were saying, yes, Daniel, earlier on, how important hydration is. That is the key thing if you're spending a lot of time training indoors. You mentioned the 1993 Milan-San Remo. That was always my favourite edition, partly because I was a big fan of Maurizio Fondries. Had a picture of him on my wall from behind on the descent of the Poggio. He attacked quite similar to Vincenzo Nibali's attack a couple of years ago to win. Fondries was in that kind of classic Lamprey kit, the purple and pink kit, and really sort of savoured his win on the finishing straight. I don't think I'd watched the race again, and I watched it on the Turbo Trainer yesterday. And, you know, it was a fairly, in a way, bog-standard edition of the race, but he really milked his victory coming to the finish. And I think that what caused the pile up behind him, because as you say, Daniel, Italian riders especially were absolutely mobbed as they crossed the line. There was a real real congestion, loads of motorbikes, it looked like a motorbike race. Also a very podgy Lance Armstrong on the attack on the Cipressa in that race. But Fondries' descent of the Poggio is one of the more famous ones, perhaps not the most famous. Lionel, you know a lot about the most famous descent of the Poggio, arguably the most famous descent of the Poggio.
Wow, yeah. From the year before, 1992. I was going to just pick up on something Daniel said about the 82 edition and the importance of the descents, because Marc Gomez, the Frenchman, probably owed his victory as much to the fact that Alain Bondu crashed twice on the descent of the Poggio. And one other thing that was unusual about that year, or something that sort of leapt out to me, thinking about how now everybody knows every meter of road, and if they don't, they go and check it out. None of the riders we spoke to for this feature went and checked out the Cipressa beforehand. You know, there wasn't a kind of a, there's a new climb in the Milan-San Remo course, so we all must go and learn what it's like. A sort of different time, of course, then. But yeah, you're right, Rich. The 1992 Milan-San Remo was kind of Sean Kelly's final hurrah. He just joined the Festina team from PDM. He was in the sort of autumn of his career, and Tom Wally has made this really nice little package, which is made up of some interviews that I did when I was working with Sean Kelly on his autobiography several years ago, and some of David Duffield's commentary from Eurosport.
So Eric Boyer it is, switching up now on towards the Poggio climb. Chosen the right time to go at the front. This is the Poggio climb.
You obviously on a good day.
Yes, I'm good in Torino.
You were good in Torino, but yep. Not...
I never showed my card. Felt good. Crashed twice. Well, got tangled up in crashes. Broke two bikes. Had a bike which was... I think about a centimetre and a half too big for me, right, going to Milan-San Remo.
Really? Yeah. So you rode a bike that was too big?
Back comes Yekimov, ploughing his way up here. He's looking back, I think, to see where Fondries has got to. He's just working at the moment as a domestic, and it looks like he's got Muzio on his wheel as well for Lotto. Great sprinter, Muzio, and that would be dangerous, I think, if Yekimov towed him right toward the top. So all he's got to do is nullify Boyer. Just grab him now, and I think he's about to do that. Although, as he eases again, it's Ariosto and it's Argentin putting on the pressure at the front. Canage. Well, Argentin looks extremely worried, I think, at the moment. He can't break this field up, and one by one his teammates seem to have disappeared under the pressure, and they pull back Boyer on that sharp hairpin. Anybody else going to have a go? And it's Argentin as he decides not to wait for the sprint. He's rocketing off the front. This is the move by Argentin. Can the rest match his move? Can the rest stay with him? Argentin then going away at the front.
Well, on the Poggio, as we came to the Poggio, you know, Argentin was there and I could see them. He was 10th place out in front. And I said, this guy is going to, he's going to give us some kicking here.
Right.
And I said to myself, I have to stay in 10th position, 15th position. And when he's going to attack, there's always going to be two or three cowboys who will go with. And they go with, then they get to him, and then it will slow down and, you know, come back as often on the Poggio. So I said, to stay with that sudden acceleration, I said, I better stay away from that, because if you do that three or four times...
It has absolutely broken apart the seams, and Jim Vandeleer has gone as Argentin has put in another attack. This man is formidable. He's got the power, he's got the pressure, he's got the few yards lead on Jim Vandeleer. Look at that, almost nonchalantly looks back to see Raul Alcala coming up as well.
I said to myself, now I'm just move up and I'll go for the descent, because I said to myself, they'll probably, some of the sprinters, if they're not there, they will come back on. And I said, I'll hit him immediately on the descent.
And Sean Kelly is chasing down Argentin, and he's closing the gap. That is certainly not 15 seconds. It's coming down, and it's Kelly that's going after Argentin. And Argentin knows he can look back and realises, having been seeing up the swirls and he was opening a gap, that somebody's coming to, and that man is Kelly.
And I said, at least I'll be second. And then I went Before we went left, I tried to go through, but Sorensen closed me.
Right.
He see me coming and he closed it.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to stop going to the corner, and then around the right, left and then the right-hander, and then the right-hander I went immediately on his right side. He tried to close me a bit, but I just bulldozed through.
Kelly now began to wind it up, Argentina in front of him.
I could see the group coming, so when he looked around, I moved well out so he could see that I wasn't blocking his vision. Yeah. And I said to myself, that'll put him in panic.
Boys have gone down with the bank. I think Thomas has gone as well. Kelly's gone away. Kelly's going to get it. Kelly gets it. Sean Kelly, the winner of the 83rd Milan San Remo. What a way. 6 hours, 26 minutes and 23 seconds of racing. And Kelly is back with a bang. And this lot are down likewise with a bang. And yes, I thought it was Motorola that bit the dust. Bad luck for them. But good luck for the Irishman himself.
They gave me a helmet sponsorship.
Right.
But the sponsorship was... it was, you know, not a lot. But on the classic, if you win a classic, there was a big bonus.
Oh, right.
And I put the helmet on before the... sometime before the Cap Alberto, Cap O'Malley.
Right.
Only the last 50
kilometers. You only wore it for the last bit.
Yeah.
Right. Ever the businessman.
Well, two things to note there. First of all, my interviewing technique, which was not for a podcast, so I'm kind of through the interview, as encouraging Sean Kelly to open up a bit. Sometimes a bit like
sometimes does need a bit of encouragement,
anyway.
Doesn't he?
He does a bit. And bless him, David Duffield. I mean, the voice of cycling for many of us who are watching through the late 80s, 90s, and up to probably the end of the 90s. But the pronunciation police would have been dishing out a few fines there, I think. But that Milan-San Remo was all about Kelly's descent and making the calculation, as he would say in his commentary, knowing that Argentina had gone over the top of the Poggio with supposedly a 13-second lead, or that at least was the information that he had, and then plummeting down the other side. But typical Sean Kelly, really. The photos of the finish, they stick in my mind because Kelly is wearing a dreadful helmet. Apologies to Brancale, who made the helmet, but it looked like a pudding bowl. There's no two ways about
that's
it.
That's us lost. Turbo Trainer sponsors, helmet sponsors.
Well, they've obviously, the designs have improved over the years, haven't they? But typical that Kelly was due a big sponsor's bonus if he won a classic wearing the helmet, but he only put it on for sort of the last 40 kilometres or so, rode the rest of the race bareheaded, as they could in those days. So ever the businessman, as I said.
Well, you mentioned the descent there, the Poggio, Napalm, and also Fondrius in 93. Fondrius, I think his wife had given birth the previous night, and he'd not yet met, he'd not yet seen his baby. I think it was a baby daughter, but he was sort of in this state of euphoria, and it was the peak, the pinnacle of his career, really, wasn't it? At that point, it looked as though, you know, he was sort of going to dominate one day races for the next few years, and then he had a lot of back problems which hindered him. But another rider for whom the Poggio was absolutely crucial was Vincenzo Nibali a couple of years ago in 2018. Not in the way that many people perhaps would have expected before San Remo, before that edition of San Remo. If you'd said Nibali was going to win it, you might have expected the attack to have come on the Poggio descent or on the Cipressa descent. It actually, he attacked initially, marking a move from Chris Neilands, the Latvian champion. He went after Neilands on the Poggio, and then, you know, they got a decent gap, and Nibali sort of forged on and won on his own on the Via Roma. And this week, Nibali, who, like every other rider at the moment, is not racing, he did a little press conference on Facebook, and we submitted a couple of questions, and they were about Milan San Remo, the edition that he won 2018, and this is what he told us about, you know, why it was exactly that, having tried for many years to go away on the Poggio, he finally succeeded in 2018.
I fattori decisivi per la vittoria sono stati.
What I think was decisive was just being able to ride with a really clear head, stress-free. I was only there in a team role to help Colbrelli, and I only had two possibilities, to try on either the Poggio or the Cipressa if there were other attacks. That was the key point. Then, as soon as I went, I felt that I had the form, the strength to win, and I didn't get overexcited. I stayed cool and just said to myself, yep, I can win this. I also knew that my team were covering for me behind. When Chris Neylands went away, I got onto his wheel, then looked around and realized that I'd gone at the right time.
Anzi, ho pensato posso farcela lì, ho attaccato e sentivo di essere coperto anche dai miei compagni.
Adesso sì, ed è Italia, grande Italia, finalmente alla Sanremo con il nostro numero uno, con lui, solo con lui poteva essere, con Vincenzo Nibali, un trionfo.
That was Nibali about the 2018 Sanremo chaps. Definitely one of the highlights of his career. I think a win that sort of took him into a different dimension. Of course, his Tour of Lombardy win came after that as well. So, you know, he went from being one of the best Grand Tour riders of his generation to one of the best riders, certainly full stop, of the last few decades, really. But a couple of other things that came out of that little Nibali press conference the other day. He was asked, as you would expect, about the Giro, which was supposed to be his objective, big goal of 2020. And he expressed the opinion that a shortened Giro would not really be a proper Giro, and that he didn't really seem very enamoured with that idea that's going around at the moment. Just the latest on that front, I understand RCS, the Giro organiser, working on a few things. One idea was for the Giro to start on the 2nd of June, which is actually a sort of national holiday, the sort of national holiday to celebrate the Republic of Italy. And that would have been quite symbolic, because it probably would be a Giro that would be entirely in Italy. Obviously, Hungary was where the Giro was supposed to start this year, but it seems possible that we could have a Giro without the Hungarian Grande Partenza. So that was one idea. Another possibility is maybe running parallel to the Vuelta, and then a third, possibly at this stage, the most likely option could be an October Giro d'Italia.
Hi guys, this is Larry Warbass, and you are listening to Lockdown with Larry. So, currently not actually locked down, because I am traveling back to the US. So, I am at London Heathrow Airport and just awaiting my flight first to Chicago and then home to Traverse City, Michigan. So, it was very much a last minute call. I had planned to stay in France and wait out the lockdown there, but it just seemed like with each coming day, there wasn't really a whole lot of positive news coming. And if you saw what was happening in Italy and Spain, it sounded like France could get worse as well. So I didn't really want to take any chances of potentially being locked down in my apartment or at altitude by myself. Potentially being locked down for like a couple months alone, which would not be ideal, especially if you couldn't ride your bike outside. So, I was actually at altitude with Will Barda, another American who rides for CCC, when we had planned on staying there for you know, the 2-week lockdown that was the initial plan in France. And then we thought we would probably go back to our apartments in Nice. But yeah, Will heard from a friend that there was potentially stricter measures coming in France, which, you know, it's really hard to say if that's just a rumor or not, but I didn't want to take a chance that it wasn't a rumor and then have some regrets potentially for the rest of my life if I got locked down so long alone. So, we made the decision to come back to the U.S. As soon as I heard, I went straight, booked a ticket for the next day out, the soonest flight I could find home. And now I'm on my way back to the U.S. So, yeah, it's definitely been a bit of a crazy, actually, last couple weeks, because I was at UAE Tour, where we also got temporarily put on a lockdown or quarantine inside the hotel. Luckily, that one only lasted 2.5 days, and most of us were able to get out. Some other guys weren't as lucky, and they were there for 2 weeks. So that definitely gave me a little scare at the start, and it was a little bit of foreshadowing of what was to come in Europe. So when we were there, we all kind of thought, we could see this going on a lot longer. We could see this potentially meaning the cancellation of some races in the spring and potentially the whole spring season. And while we were saying that to each other at the time in UAE, I don't know if we truly believed it, but sure enough, that's what has come to pass. And I don't think there's anyone in the world who expected this. And yeah, it's pretty crazy. So obviously it's much bigger than cycling. And the way I see it is, you know, I've got to do what's best for mental health right now. And, you know, that's definitely going home and spending this time with my family, because no one knows how long this is going to last. And I'm guessing it's going to be a couple months. So at least if I'm with, you know, my loved ones and at home, I'm sure it'll get tense at times. But at the moment, everyone can exercise alone in the U.S. And I think that's a really good thing for the head. So, you know, I'm looking forward to going there, riding my bike outside, keeping my distance from people, and just holing up at my parents' house. I told my mom that she can't cook too much good food, maybe like a day or two, you know, get all that yummy good stuff in. But you know, I don't want to like come out of this quarantine like 10 kilos too heavy. So I'm sure we'll race our bikes sometime again, and got to be in a good shape to be ready for that whenever it comes. So yeah, that's it for the moment. And hopefully there will be more positive news to come. We'll see. So yeah, I guess to further describe, I was at altitude because I had actually planned a training camp to get ready for Tour de Basque Country and the Ardennes Classics after that, with an eye towards the Giro. So I had booked an altitude camp at Isola 2000, a place that we go quite frequently. And yeah, Will Barda and I, we went up there. So actually as planned, and the only race that I had missed up until now was Strade Bianche. So pretty much if you just took everything away, most things were continuing on as normal. But yeah, we rented this place for 2 weeks. I had actually already been there 5 days before the real like lockdown began in France, and I'd been training. And we just decided to stay up there rather than go back to Nice when the lockdown started, because we thought maybe just being in the mountains would be more peaceful and more enjoyable, and there wouldn't be as many people, so a little bit less stress, maybe, you know, less people at the grocery store and things like that. So actually it ended up being a great move because it was really calm in the mountains. In France, everyone has to have an attestation to go outside. So that's like essentially a piece of paper that says who you are, where you're going, the date, you know, signed. And so, yeah, there were a lot of people in the mountains just walking around like normal. And, you know, there weren't any really gendarmes up there. So, you know, it was definitely a calmer place to be. And it was really not so bad. It was. You know, okay, there weren't any more people skiing anymore, but it was just really beautiful and calm and not the worst place to sit out for a while. But yeah, you know, it's different when you're there with a friend and you're able to ride your bike every day than if you're stuck inside and, you know, you can't really see the light at the end of the tunnel. So I'm still motivated to be as strong as I can be whenever the racing starts again. And for some reason, I'm just really motivated in general right now, but maybe I should like try to keep that motivation for the coming months, because I think it could be a long ride. So we'll see. Hopefully the weather's good enough at my parents' or in my hometown to ride outside. Otherwise, I'll just be stuck in the train or like everyone else, but we'll see.
Lockdown with Larry, part three. I keep thinking of all the things I need to talk about, so we'll keep adding as time goes on. But yeah, I guess a lot of people are probably curious how this is affecting our training and everything like that. And you know, I think there's a few ways to look at it. Our team, the general recommendations are, you know, to take a break for a week or two and then, you know, really start to build up after that, because, you know, I mean, their eye is that the racing will probably start end of May, maybe June. I'm thinking with each coming day, that's less likely. And I wouldn't be surprised to see end of July or August before we really start. So I guess we'll see what happens with all of that. But my idea was more to continue training hard and building up like I had originally planned. And then, you know, once we know a bit more, take a break. Because I think for the moment, the whole thing is like, you know, if you can ride outside, if you can train and you can keep your motivation, it's better to keep it for as long as you possibly can. And then, you know, that will probably wane at some point. So maybe take a break when your motivation starts to wane, and use your motivation while you have it. So I've been training pretty hard actually the last week, and I think I'll continue to do so when I get back to the US. But then after that, we'll see. Maybe try to do a good 2 to 3 week block, and then from there just take some time off for a little bit before building up again. So we'll see. I'll be flying after my altitude camp for chilling at home and eating my mom's cake, but you know, oh well.
Just before we wrap up for this week, this week's bumper episode, you can tell we've got a lot of time on our hands at the moment, eh? Hopefully you do too, the listeners. You've got a special treat coming up, so do do stay tuned for that. But we're hoping to announce in the next couple of weeks a special treat for friends of the podcast. You can still sign up as a friend of the podcast, of course, at thecyclingpodcast.com. And if you order a book, the Grand Tour Diaries, our book covering the 2018 and 2019 editions of those races, our audio diaries from those editions, the post office is still open here. We are still getting copies out. So if you'd like a copy of the book, you can get one by through our website or by becoming a good friend of the podcast. You get a signed copy if you sign up as a good friend of the podcast. Just before we say thanks to some friends of the podcast, I thought I'd name a couple of friends of the podcast who deserve special thanks. Tim Roberts, an NHS doctor who posted in our Facebook discussion group, and Marcus Banks, an orthopaedic surgeon in London who is well known to us because he once got Daniel to do a selfie with him.
Wow.
He also came on our World Championships bike ride last year, and a few years before that he replaced my hip. But Marcus got in touch with me this week as well just to say that you know, he was urging people not to ride in groups at the moment, and that is the official government advice now as well. Thanks to Tim Roberts and Marcus Banks, and thanks also to Del Ward, to Jeremy Conrad Pickles, to Colin Cheever, Gavin Bluck, Chris Boomer, Stuart Craig, Terry Muller, Stephen Lambert, Josh DePeace, and Charlie Richards.
And thanks to Zuko Nonchuba, John Painter, Ian Williams, Alan Catlin, Stefan Dixon, Boyd Scott, Dave Smith, Mark Johnson, Anne-Marie Plume, and Hugh Parker.
And a big thank you to Joel Down, Andy Day, Ian Young, Damon Bowen Ashwin, Richard Mayo, Gareth Jones, Scott Charlton, Christopher Murstick, I hope that's correct, Charles King, and Charles Twang.
And playing us out this week, hopefully this will be a regular feature, our good friend Francois Thomazeau.
When I said I needed you, you said you but you, and now you've gone away. Don't you see that now you've gone, and I'm left here on my own, that I have to follow you and beg you to come home. You don't have to say you love me just because I, you don't have to stay forever, I will understand. Believe me, believe me, I can't help but love you. But believe me, I'll never tie you down. Left alone with just a memory, life seems dead and quite unreal. All that's left is loneliness, there's nothing left to feel. You don't have to say you love me just because I, you don't have to stay forever, I will understand. Believe me, believe me, you don't have to say you love me just because I am. You don't have to stay forever, I will understand. Believe me, believe me, yeah. Believe me, believe me.
Yeah, just to play that song, because it's actually an Italian song, and it's maybe you know that, but Sanremo is well known for a cycling race, of course Milan Sanremo, but it's also well known for an annual song festival, the Sanremo Festival. And this song, you don't have to say you love me, which was made very famous by Dusty Springfield and Elvis Presley, was actually written by a guy called Pino Donaggio, and it was a hit in 1965 called Lo Queno Vivo. And there you are. So this song was made popular by this great song festival. And Pino Donaggio is not as famous as Nino Rota or, you know, other Italian composers, but he actually, you know, composed lots of themes for films, and well, notably for Brian De Palma, and for instance, Dress to Kill, or you know, other lots and lots of Italian movies. I mean, he wrote the film scores for that. So maybe not the first copy of Italian music, but a very solid, Felice di Mondi, maybe. So there you are. There was a song for the day for Milan Sanremo. You don't have to say you love me. And the Italian version once again was called Lo che non vivo senza te by Pino Donaggio and Vito Pallavicini, recorded in 1966 by Dusty Springfield, and later in 1971 by Elvis Presley, and now in 2020 by the Cycling Podcast and François Tomaso. Have a good day, all.
That's all for part one of this week's two-part episode. Part two is on the feed now. If you want to listen to it, you can do straight away.
You've been listening to The Cycling Podcast. Subscribe to our newsletter at thecyclingpodcast.com to get all the latest news and special offers delivered straight to your inbox. This episode was edited and produced by Tom Wally.